worst is the racket at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, when everyone is driving towards each other, pushing to get past, clogging up the roads. At 7 o'clock in the evening, the noise fades out, the city becomes still. The workers go home on foot, but by 9 the clamor rises anew, as the bourgeoisie head out to the theater. Around midnight, silence reigns again, broken only by the occasional rumble of the cabs bringing city dwellers home. At 1 o'clock in the morning, 6,000 farmers descend upon the city, laden with vegetables, fruit, and flowers. By 2 o'clock, the gigs and coaches of those returning late to their beds tear Parisians from their sleep. In Mercier's prose, we hear not only the stagecoaches rattling and the horseshoes clattering on the cobbles, but we also sense the growing awareness among city dwellers of the din created by the sheer numbers of their equine companions. The rhythm which pulsed through the city would not change for some time. When Émile Zola wrote of the belly of Paris 100 years later, the noise that echoes around day and night is this same infernal din. And those who are to blame for it are also the same people. Every 13th Frenchman. On the 18th of January 1766, a dispute arose at the edge of the Place de Victoire between a cab driver and an elegant aristocrat, the consequences of which were investigated by the police and registered in the archives. A driver stopped to let out his customer. On seeing that he and his own carriage were thus prevented from moving forward, the aristocratic gentleman flared up in anger and, stepping down from his carriage, beat the horse with his sword and stabbed it in the abdomen. He was eventually made to pay the cab driver for the care of the injured horse. The signature on the ensuing legal document was that of an irascible character whose name went down in history as a byword for cruelty, the Marquis de Sade. As early as the mid-18th century, Paris was the horse capital. The political, economic, and cultural revival that Paris underwent, briefly interrupted by the Revolution, but then strongly reinvigorated, was unthinkable without a great number of horses in the capital city. The horse at once represented the economic means and the energy required for everything that Paris had on show, everything that made the world marvel, from the new forms of symbolic politics and real warfare, the exercise of cultural hegemony, the rapid circulation of money, goods, and news, the spread of the arts and fashion, to the ostentatious display of wealth and a certain savoir-vivre. Nearly 80,000 horses populated the city at the height of the horse era in 1880. In the capital, we see the reflection of a nation rich in horses. In 1789, on the eve of the Revolution, almost 2 million horses grazed the pastures of France. By 1850, their number had increased to nearly 3 million, a level which remained consistent with only slight fluctuations until the First World War. Had it not been for the loss of Alsace-Lorraine, France would have owned an estimated 3.8 million horses on the eve of the First World War. Of course, the human population also rose from 36.5 million in 1852 to 41 million in 1906. But the ratio of one species to the other, of horses to men, changed by only 1 percentage point. Even then, every 13th Frenchman was a horse. Yet France was by no means in first place in terms of national horse populations. In the UK in the 19th century, there was one horse for every 10 residents. Well, in the USA, the ratio was 1 to 4, and in Australia, it was 1 to 2. In the late 19th century, there were 300,000 horses living in London. Although the 19th century city developed a higher requirement for horses than at any previous point in history, the number of horses per human inhabitant in the densely populated agglomerations was still likely to be lower than in the rest of the nation. Even between cities, within one country, there were differences, as we see in the United States, for instance. The more spacious and provincial-feeling cities of the Midwest had a far higher ratio of horses to men than the highly compressed metropolises of the East Coast. Even where the ratio was only 26.4 inhabitants per horse, as in New York in 1900, the absolute numbers are still staggering. Imagine what life must have been like in Manhattan when there were some 130,000 horses working within the city at any one time. What must it have felt like to walk along Broadway and have to dodge horse carcasses and carriages wedged into gridlock? How must a city like New York in 1900 have reeked when its horses produced 1,100 tons of manure and 270,000 liters of urine daily? And when 20 dead horses were transported away every day? The figures are even higher for the considerably larger city of London. At the Knacker's Yard, 26,000 horses per year were turned into cat food and fertilizer. Photographs from those times convey only a pale reflection of the cramped coexistence humans and horses had to endure in the city at the fin de siècle. The life of one species means the death of the other. For the horses living in and consumed by the 19th century city, seized by the storm of mechanization, it was no healthy environment. Their muscles, tendons, hooves, and joints could only endure the harsh work of providing draft power for the urban modes of transport for a few years, before they were sold on for commercial use to pull lighter loads, or allowed to return for their final years to the countryside. City horses went into retirement at the age of 5 and had an average lifespan of 10 years. This was true of omnibus horses, while tram horses tended to be exhausted after 4 years. For many, the end came even sooner, by way of permanent lameness, a sad fate concluded with a veterinarian's bullet. Between 1887 and 1897, the employees of the New York ASPCA, American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, put down between 1,800 and 7,000 horses annually. Contrary to the popular notion, the dead animal was not left to rot in the gutter. The disposal of carcasses was a mechanized process. A winch, powered by horsepower, hauled it onto a cart. A tarpaulin was thrown over it, and it was transported out of the city. In the cities of European countries, where horse meat was eaten, you would often see groups of horses, many limping on 3 legs, making their weary way to the slaughterhouse. In France, owners had their horses shaved before slaughter to make use of the horsehair. Mid-century Paris saw growing indignation among the populace at the desperate sight of shorn horses on their last legs. The increasing reliance on horses for the expansion and mechanization of urban transport changed the relationship of the city to the surrounding countryside. No longer were farms responsible only for supplying vegetables, meat, and milk for consumption by the human population of the city. Throughout the course of the 19th century, they increasingly took on the role of breeding and supplying the dietary needs of the city horses. The requirements of the horse industry opened up new, lucrative business opportunities. A horse-based economy, say the American historians Clay McShane and Joel A. Tarr, demanded enormous inputs of land, labor, and capital. The horse-powered economy required massive amounts of land, both for grazing in rural areas before migration and for food supplies after. The 3 million horses that inhabited the cities of the United States in 1900 consumed 8 million tons of hay and almost 9 million tons of oats per year. 12 million acres of land were needed to produce that quantity of fodder, about 4 acres per horse. It was not only for inner city traffic that the demand for horses rose. From the late 18th century, horses also finally took over from the ox and the ass as the main supplier of draft power in farming, Plate 5. The main reasons for this shift, besides the expansion and improvement of the road network and road paving, were improvements made to vehicles and agricultural tools, namely the plow and harrow, later also the mower. Speed became the most important factor in the economy. Saving time reaped profits. Thanks to its speed, the horse more than made up for what the ox offered in terms of power and modest nutritional requirements. The constantly growing demand for horses from this point on led to a similar increase in the number of stud farms. By the mid-century, horse breeding was at the heart of the agricultural system of most European and North American countries. No other agricultural product, be it meat, crops, or wool, held anything like as high a systemic value. The horse provided something that would become more important and more fundamental for the modern economy than protein, carbohydrates, and textiles. The provision of energy in a pure, immediately available form, with no further requirement for transformation or transference. If, as Michel Foucault put it, the régime scolaire produced the scholars, that is, the pupils and students, and the régime pénitentiaire govern the inmates of the modern penal system, so the modern agricultural regime produced the familiar repertoire of proteins, fats, and carbohydrates, but above all, animal-powered kinetic energy, which by the 19th century was supplied mainly by horses. The great powerhouse of the horse provided the prerequisite for the modern logistics and transportation systems in the expanding cities. Of course, the domestication and breeding of a second abile animal, besides the Homo habilis, came at a price, and was not without social and technical preconditions. Breakdown in the system. Paris, the 19th century world capital, was also the capital of traffic. It was little wonder there were so many accidents. Wherever there is mention of the traffic, sooner or later we hear of an accident. Regardless of who or what supplies the motive power, be it horse, ox, locomotive, or combustion engine, there always seems to be an injury or fatality in the margin of the texts dealing primarily with the technical means, costs, and risks of the act of transportation. It begins with Icarus, and Concord was not the end of it. Each and every mode of transport brings with it inherent risks and its own distinctive kind of accident. In the history of technology, each epoch has its own True Stories chapter, cataloguing the associated disasters as though it were in the mishaps, the collisions, the pile-ups, and the systemic breakdowns that we see the true essence of a technology. Again, Mercier presents himself as an early and fruitful informant. Cabs and cabbies cause untold accidents, he writes in Gao Gao, which do not interest the police in the slightest. To lend legitimacy to his critique of the traffic system, Mercier draws on his own experiences. He was present at one of the earliest urban pile-ups, at least of those that were recorded. I witnessed the disaster on the 28th of May, 1770. Its cause was a mass of vehicles blocking the road, across which poured the most enormous stream of people, a huge crowd in the dim light of the boulevards. By a hair's breadth, I avoided losing my life. 12 to 15 people were killed, either on the spot or later as a consequence of their injuries, having been crushed so terribly. 3 times I was hurled to the ground, each time by a different coach, and I was almost crushed alive under the wheels of one. It was not the criminality of certain residents that made the city of the late 18th and 19th century a dangerous place, but the forced centaurism, the horse-powered street traffic, the obligatory close coexistence of men and horses. Throughout the 19th century, the number of accidents in the cities and on the highways rose steadily, caused by bolting horses, overturning carriages, collisions, and driving at excessive speeds. In 1867, horse-powered transportation on the streets of New York caused an average of 4 fatalities per week, with another 40 pedestrians injured. In other capitals, the incidence of accidents was also well above what is typical of today's motorized traffic. Even at the beginning of the 20th century, when automobiles were beginning to be found on the streets, the cause of traffic accidents was still overwhelmingly the use and abuse of horses. 53% of accidents registered in France in 1903 involved horse-drawn carriages, 1/3 in the cities, 2/3 on the country roads. Figures for the United States around the turn of the century come out at an annual average of 750,000 accidents and serious injuries. The literature of the 19th century, whether descriptions of cities or travel, is full of lamentation about reckless drivers, drunken coachmen, toppling carriages, injured passers-by, and terror-stricken travelers. It's not the dreaded highwayman who is the traveler's worst enemy, but his best friend, the horse. But the beast is not the true cause of the accident. The problem is the system of horse-drawn transport, with all the associated cab drivers, riders, travelers, hauliers, and policemen, and all the vehicles, harnesses, and other equipment. A not inconsiderable role is played by the lamentable condition of the paths and roads, and the poor monitoring of the speed of the moving elements within the system. If we want to dig down to the root cause of so many accidents, we need to look at the Centurion system as a whole, considering all the individual parts that make up the entire horse-powered ensemble, evaluating how the players interact and how each element is articulated. It all starts with the intrinsic nature of the lead player. Horses are flight animals, easily startled and quick to resort to their instinctive flight reflex. A sudden movement in their peripheral vision, the bark of a dog, a sheet of newspaper caught by the wind, and that's it. Before you know it, the horse loses its head and bolts. A bolting horse can have fatal consequences, especially in the crush of the city, and if other horses are also alarmed. The largest horse-related catastrophe in recorded history was in New York in 1823, involving a chain reaction of panicking horses. Urban workhorses need to become accustomed to the traffic and the sights and sounds of the city. Just as in a military context, war horses need to become attuned to gunfire and cannons. But not only did the industry need horses to be bred and trained in a certain way, the men working in this new environment also had to adjust to the increasingly complex and fast-moving traffic conditions. The human animal also needed training to cope with the challenges of modern traffic. The drunken cabbie, given to spouting profanities and reckless driving, was no longer merely a nuisance for sensitive souls, a moral irritant. He had become a risk factor. He needed to be put in his place. Rules needed to be imposed and their compliance monitored by the police and, where necessary, enforced by the courts. Efforts to regulate the speed of horse traffic go back as far as the Renaissance. In a decree of 1539, Francis I of France spoke for the first time of the dangers of speeding, overtaking, and turning abruptly in the streets of the cities and on the highways of the kingdom. Yet it was not until the end of the 17th century that the first steps were taken by police forces to confront excessive speeding and careless driving. It was around 1780 that a new invention started to appear on the streets in England and France, one of those developments explored so eloquently by Bruno Latour, which, in a seamless solution to both social and technical challenges, was able to protect urban pedestrians and implement a physical division of the road by creating different levels. What we are talking about is, of course, the trottoir, or pavement, a clearly delineated, elevated walkway whose curbstone forms a physical border between the carriageway of moving vehicles and the dedicated space for pedestrians. The curb, this partition of a mere hand's breadth, which just decades later snaked for hundreds of kilometers throughout the entire city, is not merely a response in urban architectural form to the creeping centralization of the metropolis and its inhabitants. If the growth of the city in the 19th century profoundly changed the ecology of the countryside and the economy of agriculture by placing the horse at the center of the agricultural system, then it also in turn led to changes in the horse's ecology and the architecture of the city. The tens of thousands of horses living and working in the cities needed not only to be fed and watered, they also required accommodation. On a scale that is barely imaginable now, the 19th century city consisted of rows upon rows of urban stables, whose often haphazard construction out of wood and brick made them a liability in terms of both sanitary conditions and fire safety. Boston in 1867 boasted some 367 stables, each housing on average 7.8 horses. These stable blocks were dotted across the entire city, with work and transport horses deployed at the port and the railway stations, while the riding and carriage horses of the well-to-do needed to be housed within easy reach of their owners. Just like the outbuildings with coach houses below and coachmen's living quarters above that are still to be found today in the courtyards of European townhouses or the mews lanes of London, the stables were mostly located behind the houses or accommodated in the central courtyard of a block of dwellings. Most had one or possibly two stories, though in some cases, three or four-story stables were built. In the largest bus depot in southwest London, 700 horses were accommodated on two floors around a huge square courtyard. Just as the cramped cohabitation of people and horses had altered the structure and the infrastructure of aristocratic life, including the installation of palace staircases for horses, so too had the obligatory centralization of the 19th century altered its architectural features. This was also a boom time for street furniture. From the middle of the 19th century onwards, European and American cities were enhanced by the installation of troughs and drinking fountains for horses. The ASPCA counted over 100 in 1890. One of the grandest drinking spots for horses was set up on West 155th Street in New York in 1894, thanks to a legacy left by the entrepreneur John Hooper. Besides a large drinking trough for the horses, the fountain, designed by George Martin Huss, included a number of smaller drinking points at ground level for dogs, and a tap for the people of the city. The Golden Age. There was another significant factor in the tension between city and country. A certain crop had a very important place at the intersection of technology and society, particularly the upper-class elites, and that crop was oats. In addition to hay and water, oats represent the main fuel in a horse-drawn economy. Oats are rich in protein and good for horses' sensitive digestive system. Oat straw is also nutritious. With the increased use of horses, there was a clear spike in the cultivation of oats to fill their bellies. And as the use of horses declined, so too did the oat fields. The increasing use of maize as a plant-based biofuel supply in the current energy market recalls the upsurge in oat production in the 18th century. Oats boost a horse's vitality and bring a shine to its coat, which explains why the cereal was so intensively consumed in the stables of the upper classes. Thanks to a wealthy population of 4,000 aristocratic families in the 1780s, writes the historian Daniel Roche, Paris becomes the showcase of beautiful horses. It is also the place where we see the most sophisticated care being lavished on horses. With the horse, the city of the 19th century is filled with new dangers, but also new beauty. The city positively swells with unremarkable and wretched creatures, but it is also increasingly filled with swift, elegant animals and luxurious vehicles. Horses and carriages alike become objects of conspicuous consumption. The fast horse, writes Thorstein Veblen, is in general expensive, wasteful, and unusable as a workhorse. The use to which such a horse can be put, at best, takes the form of an ostentatious display of power and agility, which may at least satisfy the aesthetic sensibility. Perhaps we may concede that therein lies some benefit. It is this aesthetic sensibility that stimulates the ingenuity of craftsmen and entrepreneurs, prompted not least by a desire for variety. Even Melcier, in the late 18th century, found himself admiring the sheer abundance of various types of carriages, a range which grew from year to year. In 1838, Edouard Koloff wrote that, if he wished to describe all the carts and carriages that trundled through the streets of the French capital, he could easily fill an entire book. Between the cabriolet and the fiacre was a huge spectrum of light, mostly open-topped mongrel carriages, including the Françaises, Parisiennes, Éolines, Zéphyrines, Atalantes, and cabriolet compteur. Nevertheless, it was the classic fiacre that, despite its numerous competitors and rivals, remained the firm favorite among fathers, grandmothers, and lovers. Towards the end of the era of the horse, in 1941, the Italian author Mario Praz voiced a great paean to the time of the carriages, their noble elegance, and their steady and solemn rhythm, which no automobile will ever achieve. As long as there were magnificent equipages, Praz argued, that amidst the drumroll of scraping and pounding, the aristocrats could claim to have persevered an outward symbol of the chosen class. One last stamp of the old cavalry at the threshold of the modern age. A train of opulent carriages once resembled a frieze, like the gallant young riders of the Panathenaic procession, where men and horses marched on as if in a ceaseless, wonderful, graceful, and joyful dance of the earth. Vienna was once a city on four wheels, where beautiful Viennese ladies sat in their open carriages, showing off their elegant dresses. Fashion is the art of making fine alterations to a product, for which, strictly speaking, there is no genuine need. Differentiation on exclusively stylistic and aesthetic grounds was a feature of carriage design for the entire century. Back in 1910, Studebaker, the USA's biggest manufacturer of horse-drawn carriages, was producing 115 different types of light, two-wheeled gigs, and as many types of coaches. The end of the horse era stole up in the shadow of such numbers. 20 years later, Studebaker, who had been experimenting with horseless carriages since 1895, had completely moved over to automobile production. Besides agriculture and the armed services, the city was the heaviest consumer of horses in the 19th century. Officers, whether they were leading the French army or the armies of other nations, proved to be willing disciples of Napoleon. While they were continuously beefing up their armies, they focused particularly on a massive expansion of the cavalry and the horse-drawn artillery. In 1900, the peacetime reserves of the French army comprised 145,000 horses, a number which in the event of mobilization would rise to 350,000. Despite early experimentation with steam engines, reliance on horses was continually on the rise in the agriculture of the industrialized countries too. Machinery such as the mowing machine, patented in 1834, did not reduce the requirement for horses, but on the contrary, encouraged it to climb. The first combine harvesters that appeared 50 years later in California were drawn by 20 to 40 animals, about as many horses as were needed to transport an obelisk, writes Siegfried Gideon, reminding us in passing of the wonders of antiquity. Agricultural machinery could only save manpower by increasing the use of animal labor instead. Since one main purpose of agriculture in the 19th century was breeding horses and providing for their nutritional requirements, as urban, military, and coal and steel industry workhorses, we see at this point a kind of feedback loop within the horse-powered economy of the 19th century. In the city, the use of horses essentially served two main purposes: the conveyance of goods and of passengers. The rapid growth of cities in Western Europe and North America prompted the need for public transportation, that is, inexpensive transport connections along fixed routes at scheduled intervals. Horse-drawn omnibuses, in circulation in Paris since the mid-1820s and in London since the 1830s, also made inroads into America at this time. In 1833, New York was dubbed the City of Omnibuses. That same decade, the new mode of transport conquered virtually the entire urban road network of the United States. The omnibus carried that sector of the public who, as McShane and Tarr put it, could afford the fare but couldn't afford carriages. As fares dropped and the middle and lower classes swelled, there was a corresponding expansion in bus traffic in the cities. There was mounting competition in the second half of the century from horse-drawn trams, that is, buses which ran on rails. They combined increased comfort for passengers with reduced effort for the draft animals. A tram carriage could carry about 3 times as many passengers as a bus, and this efficiency brought the fare down. This is how rail transportation, so inconspicuous in its nature and yet so successful, would come to change the face of the city, just as a few decades later, high-rises would transform the skyline. By 1880, New York's horse cars were being drawn by nearly 12,000 horses and mules, and were carrying an average of over 160 million passengers per year. The disproportionately high numbers of passengers, draft animals, wagons, and miles of track laid, given the size of the population, can be seen as evidence of the suburbanization of cities. The expansion of the public transport network made it possible to commute into the city to work, while living and sleeping in the suburbs. The same processes could be seen a little later in continental Europe and Japan. Berlin, a metropolis that was rather late to the party, lagged somewhat behind international developments, before it too was suddenly hit by the storm of technological modernity. The first Berlin omnibuses appeared in 1846, connecting central Berlin with its suburbs, such as Charlottenburg. Running rather infrequently initially, the city's omnibus service saw an upswing in the 1860s, which was then curbed again by competition from horse-drawn trams from 1865. The faster, more comfortable, and cheaper trams pushed the buses, which were no faster than a pedestrian's walking speed, an average of 3.5 miles per hour, out of the suburbs and back into the city center. On the 25th of August, 1923, a mere three-quarters of a century after their introduction, the very last Berlin omnibus set off for Hallensee Station from Potsdamer Platz. The short summer of urban horse-drawn mass transport was already over. The expanding horse economy of the 19th century not only changed the way of life and modes of transport of the city dweller, it also allowed new occupations and ways of working to flourish, distributing them according to new criteria rather than the traditional determiners of status and rank, and thereby modifying the class structure. The ubiquity of horses, writes French historian Jean-Pierre Digard, turned figures like teamsters, coachmen, cuirassiers, knackers, breakers, hussars, farm workers, horse traders, farriers, grooms, stable masters, stage drivers, and veterinarians into trusted members of 19th century society. Horses had penetrated every area of society. They had spread through the entire culture. Breeding, husbandry, and the horse's many uses were all highly skilled subjects which required training and expertise. A knowledge of horses was no longer the preserve or the natural privilege of the nobility. The homme de cheval, who makes an appearance in the course of the 19th century, is a new kind of character of indeterminate provenance. Undetected, an agent of democratization had entered the scene. Nevertheless, the 19th century was not the golden age of the horse. The sacrifices made by the animal as a universal pulling machine on the streets and in the fields, and as combatant and comrade on the battlefield, were too great, too cruel, and too painful to be able to call it that. The 19th century ratcheted up the use and consumption of horses to a historically unprecedented level. And for a time, the 20th century carried on the same trajectory. And yet the 19th century saw horses not only exploited, tortured, and slaughtered, but also studied, bred, cared for, and admired. They were loved in their own way and for their own potential. As the period's main supplier of universally usable energy, besides human workers, the horse was placed at the heart of the economy, and around this bipolar center were aligned society's spectrum of requirements, as well as the expression of its desires and passions, its sensitivity, and its appreciation of beauty. If we consider this unprecedentedly tight network of economy and ecology, technology, society, and aesthetics as a centurion system, then we find that for this system, the 19th century was indeed a golden age. To be more precise, it is perhaps only the second half of the 19th century about which this can be said. The huge boom in the exploitation of horses did not really kick off until the late 1840s. From the turn of the century onwards, both the number and the efficiency of mechanical competitors started to multiply, most notably the automobile and the electric tram, leading to the inevitable decline of horsepower. The Golden Age lasted barely half a century. In 1903, Paris could already boast some 70 factories manufacturing motor cars. The price of energy. When we speak of the industrial revolution of the 18th and 19th centuries, we tend to think of the great technical inventions like the steam engine and the spinning jenny, and the changes to the mode of production, the division of labor, and the way of life which these innovations triggered. In this regard, we in the 21st century are still the children of Karl Marx. Here, Siegfried Gideon, the historian of technology and modernity, has vastly broadened the perspective of his readers, highlighting the impact that mechanization has had on every one of our elemental human processes, be it walking, sitting, living, eating, or killing. Nevertheless, his attention to detail, and to anonymous history notwithstanding, Gideon did not appreciate the contribution made by the horse as a forced laborer for hire, working in order to give birth to modernity, itself a historical effort of enormous proportions, which yet today is hardly recognized at all. The horse's role is like a lost continent that, even after all the historical research carried out in France and in the United States in recent years, is still waiting to be discovered. A worthy task for a new realism informed by ecology, anthropology, visual cultural studies, and the history of ideas. The industrialization of production and the mechanization of the living environment led above all to a massive hike in the demand for energy, the response to which came in the form of steam power, improvements in harnessing water and wind power, and the production and use of electricity, which itself required a greater and more efficient consumption of fossil fuels. A large proportion of the demand for energy, namely kinetic energy, needed, of course, to be met by draft animals, because with the newly available products, raw materials and markets, and with the rapidly increasing need for transport capacity for people, goods, and not least news and communications, there came a corresponding surge in demand for traction and transport. With the exception of heavy steam plows and tractors, the steam engine could be exploited only in conjunction with rails. It was only with the emergence of the relatively small, lightweight, Otto and diesel internal combustion engines that this technology could make the great leap onto the streets. Horses had to bridge both the spatial distance from the station to the back of beyond and also the temporal gulf of just over a century. At the end of the 18th century, when traffic speeds had reached a critical point and the more sluggish ox, the horse's age-old mighty competitor when it came to traction power, was left behind, the horse rose to the status of king of the road. For a century, the oat-powered engine was the universal and irreplaceable power unit in the forced mechanization of the world. Over three centuries have passed since mankind first attempted to measure the working capacity of a horse. If we want to measure a force, we need a scale against which to measure it. To this end, a comparison was made with another source of power. On the evening of the 10th of July 1688, the members of the Academy of Sciences in Paris discussed the strength of the horse, comparing it with that of men. A horse, the scholars determined by means of a special pulley, could lift a weight of 75 kilograms, 1 meter high, in 1 second, a task that it took 7 men to perform. A horse was therefore the equivalent of 7 men, they reasoned. The capacity of one half of the centaur was reflected in the strength of the other. But is man not already reflected in this equation, reduced to his mass alone? Is 75 kilograms not the weight of an average adult male? Although the ratio remained fixed at this suggestion of 75 kilograms per meter per second, it was the Scottish engineer James Watt, 1736 to 1819, who's considered the inventor of horsepower, a term that is used to this day as a measure of the performance of vehicle engines, although in most countries it has long been replaced by kilowatts. The unit of measurement has been kept alive by its familiarity, its clarity, but also the magic number at the heart of the relationship between the two species. A horse is equal to 7 men. The visible and measurable impact of the energy exerted by a horse can not only be measured by a scale, it also commands a price. As long as there was no viable alternative to the use of horses in agriculture, goods and passenger transport, in the postal sector and in mining, the horse reigned as the undisputed universal tractor. It was not until the rise of the electric tram from the 1880s, and 2 decades later, the advance of the automobile, followed by the motorized bus, truck, tractor, and all manner of vehicles with caterpillar tracks, that the oat-powered workhorse's sovereignty came under fire. It took just 2 generations to realize that the railway was far superior to the horse, in terms of power, speed, and stamina. the last generation of the 19th century realized that as motors, horses were costly, sensitive, and unreliable. Horse-powered energy was more expensive than that generated by electricity or internal combustion engines. Not satisfied with displacing the horse from the rails, ran an article in a German transport journal of 1899, "The engine is now beginning to push the horse off the streets too. The mechanical horse is lighter, stronger, faster, more enduring, cleaner, easier to steer, and, under certain conditions, already cheaper than the other kind. Once the conditions are fulfilled, which form the prerequisites for the greater affordability of the self-driven vehicle, the horse will disappear as a draft animal on our streets." In the countryside, where the horse was able to dine and lodge at less expense, the balance fell in its favor for a considerable time in comparison with the use of motorized tractors. In the city, and in cross-country transportation, on the other hand, the horse was soon superseded by its mechanized rival. These motor engines were superior to our equine friend in three respects. First, they had the economic advantage. The motor vehicle offered better performance at a lower price. Fodder, stabling, and water all came at a high price, especially in the city. The second advantage was technical. Horses are sensitive animals. They can withstand the stresses of urban transport work for only a few years, and one cannot exchange their used or defective parts. The third is an ecological or sanitary advantage. Workhorses placed a not insignificant burden on the city with their feces and urine, as well as the flies these attracted. While in our time, the motor car has a poor reputation for polluting our cities, at that time, the horse was the one condemned for contaminating the city and endangering the health of its residents. Around the turn of the century, the opinion that horses had, in today's parlance, too great an ecological and economic footprint started to become entrenched. The German Emperor Wilhelm II could talk all he liked about the motor car being a temporary phenomenon, insisting defiantly that he believed in the future of the horse. But in reality, it was merely a question of time before the biggest revolution in energy since Neolithic times. It was a case of déjà vu when, during the 2013 New York City mayoral election campaign, Bill de Blasio declared that, if elected, he would finally banish from the city the last remaining working horses. A pastoral incident. The God of Sparrows. A small town in Westphalia was dominated from the late 1950s by two rival gangs. One was called the Forest Gang, the other the Village Gang. Both recruited boys who had recently turned 10. The good boys went to high school, the bad ones joined the gangs, and then there were a few who did both. The gangs were basic social structures with a vague hierarchy, that is to say, there was a chief, but the others did more or less what they wanted. In contrast to this weak organizational structure stood the strong tradition of the initiation ritual. I cannot comment precisely on the initiation ritual for the Forest Gang, but I can vouch for the Village Gang's rites of passage. The underlings were subjected to a test of courage by the gods on high before being admitted to the illustrious club, and it clearly drew upon the old way of life. In front of their assembled peers, new boys were made to eat a local delicacy, a prominent agricultural product found in great abundance in the country, a ball of horse dung. This was common practice until 1960, at any rate. 10 years later, another item would be needed to test the mettle of would-be recruits. The supply of horse dung had dried up. The producers had vanished. The era of the horse was already over. So it was no coincidence that the consumption of their byproduct, the horse apple, came to an abrupt end. Hadn't the doors to paradise slammed shut in similar circumstances for the tasting of forbidden fruit? In 1960, the horse population in the Federal Republic of Germany was in freefall. While more than 1.5 million horses grazed the pastures of Germany in 1950, by 1970, The total figure was a mere 250,000, a sixth of what it had been two decades before. The decline seems greater yet when we bear in mind that before the First World War, there were 4 million horses in Germany, although of course then they were spread out over the larger territory of the German Reich, of which little remained after the Second World War. Of course, there were still horses in Germany after 1960. Since 1970, their number has even been on the increase again, as the horse began its new career as the plaything and soulmate of the pubescent girl. But the Pony Club is an enclave on the margins of the real world. The year 1960 was also the one in which the television set conquered the German living room. A pony club for the armchair rider, bringing magical horses into homes of viewers, from Fury and Bonanza to Mr. Ed, the talking horse. It was the dawn of a new world of equestrianism and a new experience of nature, beyond the village and the forest. Of the previous partnership of man and horse, only the human half remained. The other half, the horse, was subsumed into the secondary reality of the media. It had become a cultural icon. With the exception of certain provincial backwaters, like the villages of Westphalia, by 1960 the age of the horse was over. The horse had become the Native American of the Western world, a species that survived only in isolated conservation areas. By 1960, television sets were arriving in the homes of farmers as well as city dwellers, while at the same time the stables, where until recently horses had pawed the ground and slept on straw, were starting to empty. In areas where the land had long ago been given over to farming on an industrial scale, with endless fields, intensive use of fertilizers, and widespread use of machinery, the farewell to the horse was a relatively unceremonious affair. One morning, all that remained was one lonely animal left in the barn, which the farmer occasionally took out hacking or let his children ride, while a new, more powerful tractor had moved into the converted garage next door. In areas where villages eked out a more traditional way of life, and farming was more fragmented and old-fashioned, with a dung heap in the yard and apple orchards behind the house, the farewell was a rather slower, protracted, and more solemn affair. In some villages of the southern German and Austrian region of Allgäu, where the young men's traditional Easter ride marked the climax of the village year, this ritual still continued years after the horses were gone, the only difference being that now it was an Easter outing for young tractor drivers. The tangible lack of horse dung since 1960 caused difficulties not only for the traditionally minded section of the village youth, it was also tough on some much smaller creatures, the sparrows. For as long as there were horses, there were also sparrows, whether it was in the countryside or in the city, living in the lap of luxury. Horse droppings still contained a considerable quantity of leftovers of the horse's favorite food, oats. At any rate, what remained was more than adequate for a sparrow's appetite. This is due to the nature of the oat grain, which is more robustly packaged by the surrounding husk than the grains of other cereals. Just as small birds roam with herds of large animals in the African savanna, living in symbiosis with the rhino and buffalo, so the European sparrow lived for centuries in symbiosis with horses, albeit at a slightly greater distance, and with horse dung as an intermediary. In the eyes of sparrows, blessed God took the form of a horse. The end was all the more tragic then for them. The twilight of the equine gods also meant the disappearance of one of the main food supplies for European sparrowdom. As the horses disappeared, so was oat cultivation scaled back. Until the 20th century, oats and rye were the most important and most widely cultivated cereal in Germany. Today, oat production plays a very minor role. Its rise to become one of the most important fodder crops began when, in the 18th century and decades before the advent of the railways, the first revolution in transport occurred. When the faster horses took over the harness from the strong but slow oxen, and when passenger and freight transport on a growing network of paved roads increased in speed, rural producers had to react in terms of both livestock breeding and crop cultivation. Paved roads were laid, and farmers acquired draft horses. These had to be fed in the stable for a time, and for that, they needed to grow more oats. The cavalry brigades of European armies were also major buyers of this crop. Besides its ration of hay, a 19th century German cavalry horse was given an average 5 kilograms of oats per day. Even the pastures of the farming community were organized differently. There were changes to the way that land was being used and administered, including the pastures of the farming community, the forests, and the so-called common land. The old common land, or Allmende, as it was called in German, was gradually carved up, bringing to an end its historic shared use. The ecologist Garrett Hardin referred to this change in 1968 as the tragedy of the commons. Farming methods developed, becoming more intensive. New breeds of farm animals were introduced, and the agricultural economy was increasingly aligned with the major markets, meat and grain. In short, in parallel with the transport revolution, there was a total transformation of the system of land use, the régime agraire, as the French call it. At its center now stood our fleet-footed friend, the horse. The basis of the economy had shifted, and with it, certain fundamental aspects of life had changed. The shift in the use of the land had a vivid impact on its morphology, or rather, its perceived form as a landscape. After all, just as the terms countryside and land imply a number of economic and ecological facts, landscape denotes an aesthetic category. Stick in the mud. Swiss cultural historian Jacob Burckhardt saw the discovery of the landscape as a characteristic of the new relationship with the world that man entered into during the Renaissance. Starting with Dante and Petrarch, nature is opened up to the aesthetically critical beholder, describing the contrast between a practical and an aesthetic relationship to nature. German philosopher Joachim Ritter noted that for a man of the land, nature is divided into that which is used and that which is unused. It is only in the eyes of one who is capable of free, aesthetic contemplation that nature exists as a landscape. Even more radically, German sociologist and philosopher George Simmel described landscape as an artifact, a work of art. When we see a landscape and no longer see a sum of individual natural objects, we have before us a work of art in statu nascendi. In fact, it was artists, poets, and painters, as we see in Ritter's historical sketch, who discovered the landscape first of all, sculpted it into a certain form, and molded it into a genre of painting. Since the 18th century, the concept of landscape has also existed as a category of geography, as a description of the typical structures of the Earth's surface. This sense of a subjectively perceived excerpt of nature is also how German economist and sociologist Werner Sombart describes the landscape in his History of the German Economy of the 19th Century. However, nature considered in economic terms bears the footprints of history and trade. It is shaped by the work of men and women and the imprint of industry. In the morphology of the landscape, we read the history of agriculture and the progress of mechanization. Sombart's economic history of Germany begins with an opening sequence that's reminiscent of an early film, a kind of road movie. As if filmed with a jerky handheld camera, in the first 20 pages, the author follows a carriage ride through Germany 100 years ago. The ride is jarring and uncomfortable. The picture jumps and wobbles. There is constant cause to grumble. It begins with a lack of paved highways and the miserable state of the byways. Endless reports of carts getting bogged down, including postal workers asphyxiating in the mire. The state of the roads corresponds to that of the vehicles. At that time, the postchaise was one of the most popular and most plentiful laughing stocks. Sombart cites Ludwig Born's classic piece of satire, The Natural History of Mollusks and Testacea, a monograph on the German post snail that opens with the author's jest that, although his journeys had provided him with an endless supply of comical anecdotes, he had failed to note any of them down, for it had been quite impossible to capture a single word on paper. I struggled to write down a single observation, for every jolt caused my thoughts to bolt. The rattled traveller in Bjorn's send-up goes on to voice his mockery of every single participant in the postal service. The coachman, the horses, the packers, the postmasters, and the passengers. They all play their part in the great snail project of slowing everything down. According to his Statistics of the Post Chaise, where Bourne interprets statistics as remaining static, the route from Frankfurt to Stuttgart is reckoned to be a drive of 40 hours, but with 14 rest stops adding up to a total of 15 hours of idling, so that over certain stretches, the carriage has trouble keeping up with a sturdy pedestrian. In this case, it wasn't even the quality of the highway that was under fire. Bourne suffered less from impassable terrain and inclement weather than from the inertia of the personnel. Goethe, on the other hand, in his Notes on a Journey, recorded the deterioration of the roads as he crossed from one state into another, or from one religious denomination to another. This was his third trip to Switzerland. No sooner was Tübingen behind him, and he had entered into the Catholic region of the Hohenzollern, than the dreaded bone-shaking commenced. The moment one leaves the Wittenberg region, the treacherous roads begin. The reason the bridge needs the good St. John of Nepomuk is surely because of the terrible road surface. If a carriage is sent skidding, it is not always the dreadful quality of the track that is to blame. A harmless dead creature in the road is enough to stop the wheels. In Lawrence Stern's A Sentimental Journey, it is a dead donkey that causes the bidet, a small French post horse, to lose its wits. The horse flinches and, refusing to pass the corpse of its deceased colleague, it throws Lafleur, the postillion, from its back. Cursing, the rider mounts his steed again, beating him up to it as he would have beat his drum. The bidet flew from one side of the road to the other, then back again, then this way, then that way, and in short every way but by the dead ass. Lafleur insisted upon the thing, and the bidet threw him. "What's the matter, Lafleur," said I, "with this bidet of thine?" "Monsieur," said he, "c'est un cheval le plus opiniâtre du monde." "Nay, if he is a conceited beast, he must go his own way," replied I. And as Yorick, the narrator suggests, this is what happens. Land considered in economic terms is either arable land or forest, used for pasture or for industry. From this perspective, it is termed a terrain, or Gegend in German, depending on its condition or status. The terrain is the epitome of what stands in the way of or opposes man's desire to proceed and progress. When seen as a terrain, the land is quantified in terms of distance and breadth, peaks and chasms, in its rock and mountain, water and marsh. It may be passable, ford, ravine and clearing, or impassable, thicket, wilderness and swamp. Until the late 18th century, and the early days of modern road construction, with its fixed carriageways supported by bridges and arches, the road is a tortuous labyrinth winding its way around a thousand obstacles, man's meandering compromise with the obstinacy of the unsystematic opponent that is nature. In other words, the path is the complicated, not exactly mathematical function of human will to overcome a distance multiplied by the indomitable resistance of natural objects. It is not until the railway's iron will breaks the landscape's resistance that the road can then hesitantly meander alongside it. Even today, the curve of the highway preserves the memory of the twisting old road as it once snaked between river and mountain, forest and valley. If we consider the concept of the terrain more closely, wrote Prussian staff officer Karl von Clausewitz, and don't lose sight of the lie of the land, we become aware of three means by which a terrain can distinguish itself from the baseline of pure level ground, as it were. Firstly, the contours of the earth, that is, the elevations and depressions. Secondly, the natural phenomena covering it, whether it's forests, marshes, or lakes. And finally, the product of its cultivation. It is this same unholy trinity that the horse-drawn carriage had to contend with as it traversed the rural terrain. As in the case of the general staff, the coachman on his box wrestled not only with the inertia of his draft animals and his own beastly exhaustion. In a literal sense, he experienced the obstacles the terrain had to offer and the friction, as Clausewitz puts it, of the track as his first natural enemy. In all three cases, wrote Clausewitz, perceiving the relief of the terrain, the vegetation, and its cultivated products, war is made more intricate and more elaborate.